بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. All praises are Allah's Lord of the worlds, and may His peace and blessings be upon our Master, the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and His pure Immaculate Ahlul Bayt. But concerning the question that Brother Rahal asked, the Nafsul Mutma'inna is used in the feminine sense. Here, the spirit is one. The eye is one. This eye, depending on how it acts in this world, it acquires a number of different states. If the eye decides to sin predominantly, it's called the Nafsul Ammara. Not that it's a separate soul, it's a status quo of the eye as a result of its actions. If the eye sins in this world and then regrets it and reproaches itself, it's called the Nafsul Lawama. It's not another soul, but it's of a higher degree. It actually reproaches itself after sinning. And then there's a status of this soul where one becomes mukhlas, not mukhlis, but mukhlas now. And then we call the eye as having reached a state, and that state being referred to as nafsul mutma'inna. So these are states of that one eye that we are, which I was saying is sexless. But in Arabic, sometimes to these states, they use the literal masculine term or the feminine term. In this case, this status of the soul, the nafs, is the literal feminine gender is used. But not that it's a separate being or it's separate to that I. The I is something else, depending on how it acts in this world. There, different number of states arise, and that's what we get it. So it's not referring to an I, it's referring to a status quo, which in Arabic, this nafs is regarded, the status quo of the I is used in the feminine literal sense, not in the feminine real sense, as if it's a woman or something. Okay. It was a good question, though. I never paid attention to that. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The dispositions, the spiritual status quo, the ethics, the mental constitution, the bodily constitution, all these of the parents play a significant role in the spiritual status and ethics and temperament of the offspring. The dispositions of the parents, the bodily, the mental, the spiritual constitution of the parents, how the parent thinks, how the parent behaves, how the parent treats one's neighbors, one's family. All these play a significant role in the bodily and spiritual status quo of the offspring. That's one point. One step higher. The dispositions, the spiritual status, the bodily constitution, the ethics of one's grandparents, great-grandparents, and keep on going higher. They all have an effect and a role in relation to the offspring one day. One step higher. Even the intentions of the parents, the way they think, has an effect on the embryo, or the intentions of the grand, great-grandparents, and so on and so forth, has an effect on the succeeding embryo, which is going to be born one day in the future. Even the way the parents think, the way they behave, will have an effect at the time of conception. Also, the way the parents think, the way they act, the way they earn during the 9 months of gestation, and so on and so forth. So from preceding generations to before conception to at conception, after conception, there's 1,001 different parameters at play which contribute to the bodily and spiritual constitution of the offspring. And this can be extracted from the logic of the traditions from the Ahlul Bayt. Why is this important? Because a significant amount of our destiny is in the hands of those who preceded us. This responsibility in relation to the preceding generations. They're responsible to some degree in relation to our destiny. Every act one does right now, whether you're eating, speaking, listening, from moment to moment, every act you do, every intention you have, the way you think, the way you talk, and everything right now has some influence and some role in the development of your succeeding offspring. It may be one generation away, two generations away, it may be 50 generations away. The potential is there. When it comes to the physical or medical realm, it's easy and everyone accepts this. There's no problem there. If a woman smokes or drinks or takes certain medication and then they give birth to a child with some kind of disability, let's say without a limb, everyone accepts that the woman is responsible. Everyone accepts that the destiny of the child has been shaped to some degree by the woman's actions. There, no one has a difficulty in accepting. And you see the woman every week, she goes to the midwife, the doctor, she takes folic acid and other medications. It's important for her, because she knows, she acknowledges that she's shaping the destiny, albeit physical, in the physical domain of the child. And you never see women missing out on that. However, when it comes to the spiritual realm, here people have difficulties. Islam doesn't have a difficulty here. Islam, it's very straightforward. Islam has given the codes. But since people like me and you are drowned in the physical world, we don't understand these codes and we don't accept them. How many parents do you see going to a spiritual doctor before conception? You don't see anyone. And then when the child has difficulties of a spiritual nature or mental or even bodily after birth, then they refer for doors and everything, but it's too late. In the same way that parents' actions can affect the child physically, there's no doubt, according to the logic of the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, the women's and husbands and all the previous great grandfathers, great-grandfathers, grandmothers, their intentions, actions, behavior, all have a spiritual effect on the offspring too. And this is neglected. And this is important. Nisa'ukum harthul lakum. Your women are your cultivating land, if you like. Those 9 months of gestation, something's going on there. It's important. For conception, okay, the male and the female have equal contribution there. But the 9 months of gestation, the way the mother thinks, the way she behaves, the way she earns, what she eats, how she speaks, it's building the child. We'll come to traditions in a minute. What started as a unicellular embryo suddenly after 9 months becomes three to four kilograms of mass. The newborn. Where is the newborn getting all this weight? The mother's flesh, mother's own existence is granted to this newborn. Not only physically, but the way she thinks. Her anxieties will have an effect. Her spirituality will have an effect. Her bodily constitution will have an effect. One of the reasons why women can't have more than one husband is this. Because the woman who is a nurturer during the 9 months of gestation, how she thinks, how she behaves, how she intends, is shaping this fetus. Now you imagine that she has two or three other husbands. What's going to be the effect on that fetus? There are some traditions that say that don't have intercourse in front of children. It has a negative effect. The child will enter vice. The potential is there, at least. I'm not saying it's a definitive equation. When the tradition says that don't do this action because this will happen, it doesn't mean it's definitive. It just means the potential is there. The point is you're shaping the child. That action in front of the child is not allowed. It'll have a bad effect on the child, 4 years old, 5 years old, whatever. Let alone the fetus, what effect that will have if the woman is occupied with more than one husband. These are important reasons. Now, in the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, there are many traditions that actually open this up. Some of the traditions are weak, some of the traditions are strong and sound. Overall, there is tawatur in meaning. One has yaqeen that these things exist because of the increased number of these kinds of traditions. One tradition which I've chosen to read parts of, because it's a very long tradition, is a prescription that the Holy Messenger gave to Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam and Lady Fatima alayhi salam on their wedding night. And it's a very important tradition. A lot of codes, secrets of the cosmos are revealed here. And this is for two people who were ma'soom. But it applies to us too. But even for the ma'soomeen, these codes were given. I'll just read some of the clauses of this very important tradition. Ya Ali, the Holy Messenger said, La tujami'a imra'ataka في أول الشهر ووسطه وآخره. Oh Ali, don't have intercourse with your wife at the start of the month, the middle of the month, the lunar month, the Islamic lunar month, and the end of the month. فَإِنَّ الْجُنُونَ وَالْجُذَامَ وَالْخَبَلْ يُسْرِعُ إِلَيْهَا وَإِلَى وَلَدِهَا. Because insanity, like a form of psychosis, leprosy or some form of skin disease, and dementia will be transmitted to the woman and to the offspring. See? That's not to say this will happen 100%, but the potential is there. The potential is there. In some traditions it says, don't do the act after dhuhr, in the afternoon, because it has an effect on the eyes, a physical effect on the eyes. The same tradition, يا علي لا تتكلم عند الجماع. During that act, don't speak. It'll have another negative effect. One by one, it's going through these codes. Don't see X part of the body during the act, because this will happen. In another part of the tradition, يا علي لا تجامع امرأتك بشهوات امرأة غيرك. Don't do the action with your wife after being excited via another woman. So you became excited through another woman, then you approached your wife and you were occupied. These are important. I mean, one has to say these things on the member. It's nothing to be ashamed of. The words of the Imams, it's important. Let's get rid of the cultural taboos. I think we've had enough of those. This is Islam now. Taboo free. We want to learn Islam. So, don't do that then. Being excited with another, then going towards your wife and getting involved in the act. فَإِنِّي. Now he wants to give the reason why. I, the Holy Prophet is saying, أَخْشَى. I fear. إِنْ قُضِيَ بَيْنَكُمَا وَلَد. Because if an offspring, in this case saying a male offspring, is procreated, is conceived, أَيَّكُونَ مُخَنَّثًا مُؤَنَّثًا مُخَبَّلًا. It'll be the male, assalamu alaikum, the male offspring, I fear, will be effeminate, woman-like, and suffer some form of dementia. مُخَبَّلًا, I think that's the meaning. If someone can correct me there, I'm not sure, yes. In some, the same tradition, if you do the act without wudu and the woman is pregnant, it speaks of the child potentially, I stress, becoming miserly. See? Here, the reason we don't accept these things is because we're so drowned in the physical world. We just, most of us just say, oh, forget it, this is all just fables and everything. That's your decision. My responsibility is to share these with you. The potential is there. Not only will you suffer as a result of only this act, the timing, how it's done, not only will you lead to the suffering of a bodily nature to the child, but also mental and spiritual deficiencies can arise, and you're responsible. Now imagine the parents, the grandparents, the great-grandparents, all of them. They all thought purely. They all behaved purely, generation after generation. So one's father, one's mother, one's father's mother and father, and their mother and father, but on the other side too. They thought purely. The ethics was pure. The way they spoke was pure. Everything was pure. They earned purely. They ate purely. They did all this. Here, the offspring will be of a bodily and spiritual constitution that is called Ismat. They become Masul. On birth, as a result of that purity and taqwa which continued for generations and generations, this is a product, a ma'asum offspring procreated as a result of the preceding generations. That's the potential. That's what we mean by the prophets and the imams being born ma'asum. It's possible. I mean, medical science is going towards this direction, but it's going a bit slowly. It's still on the phase of, well, the bodily deficiencies, that's now proven. The mental deficiencies are also proven. And if they're born in this environment, where it's very noisy, or if they mention a number of scenarios, the child will suffer. Now this is all this data and evidence to prove this. But they haven't gone into the spiritual realm yet. Not with time, inshallah. The point is, the mother and father, all the preceding, everything was pure, taqwa. The offspring becomes pure, bodily wise, spiritually wise, and at birth, the status of Ismat is there. Not as a result of that child's doing, a result of the preceding generation's way of thinking, intending, and acting. Now, preserving that Ismat is more difficult than acquiring it. That is in relation to the child now. And as he grows, preserving that Ismat is much more difficult. These are two different phases. Being granted Ismat and then preserving that Ismat. And that's the rational justification of being born infallible. It's possible. In the traditions, in the texts, it's referred to this concept. Ashhadu an in ziyarat al-warith. Ashhadu annaka kunta nuran fil aslam al-shamikha wal arham al-mutahhara. I bear testimony that you, O Imam, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, you were a light in the lofty wombs. All your mothers, one after the other, mother, grandmother, all those, all lofty people, they thought purely, they acted purely. And this led a light until it came to your birth. The Arham al-Mutahharat, that's what it's referring to. The pure wombs. Aslab al-Shamikha is referring to the lofty, the sperm, father after father, generation after generation. These pure fathers that Imam Hussein had, they thought purely, acted purely. That sperm, the transmission from generation after generation, it led to this pure birth of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Lam tunajjiska al-jahiliya bi-anjasiha. The era of ignorance didn't pollute you with its contaminations. It's a very important clause, this. If one understands this clause, one will understand why they couldn't have been a 13th imam. It had to stop at the 12th. And that's why qaybat had to occur, occultation. The era of ignorance doesn't or didn't pollute you with its contaminations. The mothers, the fathers, all pure, one after the other. Sometimes you see children who maybe the father or mother aren't very practicing, but they become very religious because of what their grandmother, their grandfather, their great-grandmother. Sometimes you see the good actions of the previous generations, not the direct parents, can have an effect on the offspring. The potential is there. Or, for example, with converts, do you think it's easy to convert from Christianity, for example, to Islam? Do you think the convert at 16 or 20 or 25, they did it all by themselves to convert? It's almost impossible to convert. Since we were born Muslims, we take it for granted, but and true conversion to Islam from another religion, it's almost impossible. It's very unlikely that it's only because of that convert that they managed to convert to Islam. That convert who was Christian, for example, their parents, their grandparents, their great-grandparents, they were believers at the end of the day. They were still believers. They did good actions. Those good actions one day contributed to an offspring many generations down accepting Islam. And then when that convert accepts Islam, it'll be a day of joy and jubilation for those of his preceding generations who have passed away and are now in wherever they are. They will receive heavenly provisions. It's a day of joy. It's an honor for them that someone in some way, many generations down, they believed in Islam. But all these, it contributes to that. It's not the convert alone. It's possible, but it's unlikely. In any case, these actions from our parents upwards, it has an effect. The potential is there. It can be a good effect, it can be a bad effect. However, sometimes some sins are worse than others in relation to how it has an effect on the offspring. One of those sins which have more of a negative effect compared to other sins in relation to the development of the offspring is when the child is born out of wedlock. Here, this becomes a bit of a problem. In relation to the child, him or herself, there's no bias in Islam in relation to that child. That child, like me and you, also has the potential to acquire spiritual perfection. The door is still open. It's not as if it's closed. No. That child can do all the things that we can do, can marry and everything. There's no social bias. In some cultures, there is a bias, but not in Islam. However, there is something that Islam had to do in such cases. And it's not because of the child, him or herself. It's because of this significant potential threat that the parents who are responsible for it, they did. Nothing to do with the child. But at the end of the day, it happened. Some things you can't deny. They had medication, now the child has no limb. You see, you can't make them an athlete. for example. You'll never choose that child, for example, to go to represent your country, for example, in the 100 meter sprint or something. There's some limitation there at the end of the day. But spiritually too, there's a significant threat which has now been posed to this offspring. Because of this significant, although the road to spiritual perfection is still open for the child, but he has been limited. He is at a disadvantage, but he can, with a strong will and resolution, he can overcome that. He may not overcome that. That's up to the child. What's undeniable is that a significant risk has now been given to this child. Since this potential is there, and this significant potential, I stress, spiritual threat, has been granted to the child, Islam, as a precautionary measure, doesn't allow that child to enter professions where the salvation of the masses are at stake, like being a manager, for example, or being a judge, and maybe one or two other things. The child actually may acquire so much knowledge, and maybe stronger knowledge-wise than all the maharaja and the judges. The potential is there. But Islam, as a precautionary measure, couldn't risk or compromise the salvation of people. And since this risk is significantly negative, this being born out of wedlock, although it's nothing to do with the child has nothing to blame, the route to the child's spiritual perfection is still open, but Islam says you can't enter those professions. You can think of physical examples where certain physical defects, you can't enter certain professions. The same applies in the spiritual realm. In any case, the thing is that our parents, grandparents, and so on and so forth, there's 1,001 different parameters which are at play in relation to the procreation of that offspring. Now, I want to mention one of those parameters now in some detail. Ibn Sina, who was a very important scholar in Islam, throughout Islamic history, he's one of the very important scholars. And he was, if you like, a mujtahid in not only fiqh and usul and even the seminary sciences, but also in the physical, natural sciences. He was a specialist in his own right. His books were taught in the West until one or two centuries ago. But his books are still being researched in the West. He has written something in relation to breastfeeding. I want to go through this Arabic text and translate it at the same time. And look at, it's only one parameter. How this one parameter has an effect on the social well-being, the spiritual well-being of the child. Now, this is Ibn Sina talking. It's not why. I'm not saying this is 100% true, but it has elements of truth to it. He says, أَمَّا كَيْفِيَّةُ إِرْضَائِهِ وَتَغْذِيَتِهِ, concerning the manner of breastfeeding and feeding the offspring. فَيَجِبُ, it's necessary. It's not canonically necessary from a Sharia point of view. It's just an instruction. It's necessary, أَيُّرْدَأَ مَا أَمْكَنَ بِلَبَنِ أُمِّهِ, to breastfeed that much which is possible from the mother's milk. فَإِنَّهُ أَشْبَهُ الْأَقْضِيَةِ بِجُوْهَرِ مَا سَلَفَ مِنْ غَذَائِهِ, because this milk is the most similar thing to that which used to be the food of the offspring, وَهُوَ فِي الرَّحِمِ, whilst the offspring was in the womb, أَعْنِي كَمْثَ أُمِّ, i.e. the blood of the mother, this milk is the most similar thing to that which used to be the food of the offspring when it was in the womb of the mother, i.e. the blood. This milk is the most similar thing to the blood. فَإِنَّهُ بَأَيْنِهِ This blood per se هُوَ الْمُسْتَحِيلُ لَبَنًا It's converted to milk. وَهُوَ أَقْبَلُ لِذَلِكَ And this milk is most befitting for the purposes of this nutrition. وَأَوْلَفُ لَا And it's the most closest thing, most familiar thing to the child. حَتَّى أَنَّهُ قَدْ صَحَّ بِالتَّجْرُبَةِ And it's reached this point that evidence or experience has proven that أَنَّ إِلْقَوْمَهُ حَلْمَةُ ثَدِّيَ أُمِّي عَظِيمُ النَّفْءِ جِدًّا فِي دَفْءِ مَا يُؤْذِي Even the grasping of the offspring's mouth upon the bosom of the mother, only the grasping, not even the breastfeeding, the suckling, even the mere grasping is of mighty importance, and it eliminates many of the harms encountering that child, the mere grasping. وَأَمَّا شَرَائِطُ الْمُرْضِعِ فَسَنَذْكُرُهَا Concerning the prerequisites, not the canonical prerequisites. Concerning the prerequisites of the mother who is breastfeeding, the woman who is breastfeeding. We shall mention them later. وَنَبْدَوْ But we'll start بِشَرِيْتَةِ السِّنَّهُ We'll start with the prerequisite of the age of that woman who breastfeeds. فَنَقُولْ And we say أَنَّ الْأَحْسَنَ أَنْ يَكُونَ مَا بَيْنَ خَمْسَ وَإِشْرِينَ سَنَةً إِلَى خَمْسَ وَثَلَاثِينَ سَنَةً The best age to breastfeed is between 25 and 35 years of age. This is Ibn Sina's own experience. In reality, it may be something else. It may be 15 to the 30. I don't know if this is his own findings here. فَإِنَّ هَذَا هُوَ سِنُّ الشَّبَابِ وَسِنُّ الصِّحَّةِ وَالْكَمَالِ Because this age is the age of youth, the age of sound health, and the age of perfection. وَأَمَّا فِي أَخْلَاقِهَا But concerning the woman's ethics. Now this is the main point. That was just a preface to this. Concerning the woman who's breastfeeding, concerning her ethics. فَأَنْ تَكُونَ حَسَنَةَ الْأَخْلَاقِ She has to be of decent ethics. وَمَحْمُودَتَهَا She has to be of praiseworthy ethics. بَطِيئَةً مِنَ الْإِنْفَعَالَاتِ الرَّدِيئَةِ She has to be delayed, slow. In what? She has to be slow in being susceptible to negative behavior. She shouldn't be of the type that becomes very susceptible to vicious behavior and unethical behavior. No. If she's surrounded by unethical women, for example, she doesn't become susceptible to that kind of behavior quickly. She's strong. It takes time before she gets affected. She doesn't easily become negatively affected. بَطِيئَةً مِنَ الْإِنْفَعَالَاتِ الرَّدِيَّةِ Then he gives examples. مِنَ الْغَذَابِ For example, anger. She doesn't become angry quickly. وَالْغَامِ Disappointed, depressed. Not clinical depression, but you know. She doesn't become depressed quickly. وَالْجُبْنِ Cowardice. She doesn't become a coward quickly. وَغَيْرَ ذَلِكَ And other negative traits, other vice. فَجَمِيعُ ذَلِكَ All these vices يُفْسِدُ الْمِزَاجِ It ruins her constitution, bodily or spiritual. It ruins it. وَرُبَّمَا أَعَدَى بِالرِّضَى. And this ruining of the constitution can be transmitted أَعَدَى بِالرِّضَى, by means of breastfeeding. Through the milk it can be transmitted. وَلِهَذَا نَهَى رَسُولُ اللَّهِ. And because of this, the messenger of Allah صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم نَهَى أَنِ اسْتِذْعَارِ الْمَجْنُونَ. He prohibited, not canonically, but he advised against using women who are insane, for example, to breastfeed. It will have an effect on the child. The potential is there. You see how important this, the concept of milk, is here. Amirul Mu'mineen alayhi salam, knowing of the event of Karbala, produced, procreated with a particular agenda in mind for that day in the marriage of Ummul Baneen alayhi salam. He said, has to be from Bani Kalab, the woman. Has to be a fighter. You see, he was preparing for the procreation of Abbas alayhi salam. This is an important point. We have to do that. Now, Amirul Mu'mineen alayhi salam in one tradition has said, "Unzuru man turdhi'u awladakum." Observe carefully who is breastfeeding your child, your offspring. فَإِنَّ الْوَلَدَ يَشُبُّ عَلَيْهِ. Because the child will be blended with the attributes of that woman. Observe this carefully. You're shaping the child. Imam Baqir alayhi salam said, اسْتَرْضِعْ لِوَلَدِكَ بِلَبَنِ الْحِصَانِ. Breastfeed your children with the milk of those with decent ethics. وَإِيَّاكَ وَالْقِبَاهِ. And refrain from this breastfeeding through those who have attributes of vice. Then he gives a code, a very important code, 1400 years ago. فَإِنَّ اللَّبَنَا قَدْ يُعَدِّي. Because milk, it transmits. You see? It's not only a bodily transmission, but even spiritual. وَإِيَّاكَ وَالْقِبَاهِ. وَعَلَيْكُمْ بِالْحِسَانِ. There's nothing to do with the bodily aspects here. Even spiritual attributes, mental attributes. إِنَّ اللَّبَنَا قَدْ يُعَدِّي. It can be transmitted through milk. It's a principle. It's a code. عَلَيْكُمْ بِالْوِضَاءِ مِنَ الدَّعُورَةِ. Earlier I enjoined, also from Imam Baqir, I enjoined that the breastfeeding mother be in a state of wudu when breastfeeding. فَإِنَّ اللَّبَنَا قَدْ يُعَدِّي. Verily milk transmits. You see, there are 1001 different parameters that all have a role in this shaping of that procreation. Okay, now that's one point. The next point, these are all linked together, but the next point is this, that the Sharia, the halals and the harams, the wajibat and the muharramat, where are they extrapolated from? Are they just conventional, arbitrary matters? Or are they based on something from which they're extrapolated from? Here in Islam, we believe that Islamic law, the obligations and the sins, the legislation in general, they're extrapolated from the laws of nature, the laws of the cosmos, They're not just conventional do's and don'ts willy-nilly. It's based on nature, or based on whatever is. I'll just give one example of that. Amir al-Mu'mineen has said, لَيْسَ شَيْءٌ تَغِيبُ أُذُنَا إِلَّا وَهُوَ يَبِيدُ. Whatever creature whose ears are hidden, they lay eggs. وَلَيْسَ شَيْءٌ تَذْهَرُ أُذُنَا إِلَّا وَهُوَ يَلِدُ. And whatever creature whose ears are apparent, can be seen, they give birth to offspring. Now someone may ask, you know, what about the whale, for example, or where the ears are hidden? But it's a mammal. Here, maybe it's only in the terrestrial realm. And even with the whale, we have to see exactly how the ears are. But here, maybe it's in reference to the dry land. Maybe ears in marine life has another ruling. It can't be outside or something. I don't know. I haven't researched this. But as a result of the way the ears are positioned, there's a relationship between that and their giving birth, either laying eggs or giving birth to their offspring. You see, there's a link here. Now, once someone came to the Imam, that was just to have an understanding of the principle. Once someone came to the Imam and he said, look, we encounter eggs in the jungle. How would we know if these eggs are from halal meat animals, making it permissible to consume, or if the eggs are from haram meat animals, making the eggs impermissible to consume? Here the Imam says, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, Mastawa tarafa fala ta'kul. If the two ends of the egg are uniform in size, don't eat. This don't eat is part of legislation. What is this don't eat based on? The law of nature. The two ends of the egg. How are they? If they're uniform in size, don't eat. Meaning it's of a haram animal. وَمَخْتَلَفَ تَلَفَا. But if the two ends of the egg are different in size, like cone-shaped or tapered, if you like, fakul, eat it. It's from a halal animal. Haram meat animals produce this form of egg structure, don't eat. Halal meat animals produce this form of structure, eat. See, legislation extrapolated from the laws of nature here. That haram meat animal is a haram meat animal. And being a haram meat animal, it transmits haram attributes to the offspring. And then we're told not to eat it. The reason foods, some animals are haram to consume, some animals are halal to consume, is this. The pig is haram to consume because you'll acquire pig attributes. Predators are haram to consume, the wolf, the tiger, the lion, because you'll acquire predator attributes. Even if an animal is not a predator, but has predator instincts, it's haram to consume. And that's why the rabbit is haram to consume, for example. The reason why the cow, the sheep, the camel, it's okay to consume, because their attributes are inert, neutral. It doesn't really, they don't have anything specific, which can specifically harmful, like the wolf has, for example, which can be passed on to the person, or like the pig has, for example, or the dog has. But even with those animals, if you eat a lot of meat, and in the traditions, one has to have little meat, not too much meat, because then you may become inert too, like those animals, in your sleeping and in your behavior, you know, being. So those haram meat animals, they produce an egg of a certain nature. Don't eat. Halal meat animals produce eggs of another shape or size. Eat. So legislation extrapolated from the laws of nature. Or another tradition, مَا كَانَ مِنْهُمْ مِثْلُ بَيْدِ الدُّجَاجِ فَكُلْ. If the egg is like the egg of a chicken, eat. The egg of the chicken being cone-shaped, being tapered, that's okay. Now, snakes, for example, their eggs long and uniform, the sides are uniform. Don't eat, it's from a snake, has snake attributes. Sharia says don't eat it. And other reptiles, their eggs uniform, don't eat. But with sparrows, nightingales, those things, the eggs are cone-shaped, it's okay to eat. Then it's interesting, amongst the birds which are halal to eat, some najis-consuming birds, their eggs are, even though it's permissible to eat, but their eggs are less asymmetrical than other birds. You see, they just consume najasa. It has an effect on the eggs. Some birds, for example, who live on the cliff very high up, their eggs are more oval-shaped than other eggs. You see, diet, place, all these things have an effect on the eggs, on the offspring. And the same applies to human beings. When they conceive, how they're conceiving, their thoughts. Are their thoughts like snakes? Are their thoughts like pigs or wolves? Or are they real humans who are conceiving? Some people can have the attributes of animals. They may be predators as a result of their sins. Then Ayatollah Hasanzadeh sums it up very well. All this was from one of his books in relation to Lady Fatima alayhi wa sallam. He says that the ultimate wisdom in marriage is to establish a human form, not merely to satiate one's needs. Permanent marriage isn't to satiate one's needs. That there's something else for that. Permanent marriage is to procreate a true human, not phenotypically, the external side. You want to shape a true human at birth with those positive spiritual attributes, shaping its destiny in a positive way. But if you don't care in relation to conception and you consume haramly, you earn haram, you speak haram, you think haram, even though you were born, you married according to the Islamic contract and you gave birth in wedlock, and the child looks like any other human being and is of legitimate birth, but spiritually it will be of illegitimate birth. You've given rise to a snake as a result of how your actions were, to a predator. God knows what will happen to that child. The ultimate wisdom in marriage is to form a human at birth, not the physical one. That spiritual potential has to be given. This is the wisdom behind marriage. Okay, I'll finish there. Just one last point. Inshallah, from tomorrow I will do Zikr al-Musiba. But just one point, because it's in relation to this. They asked Imam Sadiq, alayhi salam, how could that person, I won't mention the name, there's no need, how could that person beat Lady Fatima alayhi salam? It takes a lot to beat someone like Lady Fatima. The offspring of the Holy Prophet, the birth of Lady Fatima, what the Holy Prophet did 40 days before that, what Lady Khadija did. Pure thoughts, pure actions. A ma'soom child, Lady Fatima alayhi salam, for a number of years, she lived purely, thought purely, from moment to moment, had mi'rajes and so on and so forth. It doesn't make sense for someone to beat such a person. This was asked to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. The tradition is in Bihar al-Anwar. Then Imam Sadiq said, look at the genealogy of that person. Look at the parents, the grandparents. Look at what happened. You see, today's lecture was on this. And then he goes into the genealogy. And what happened was this. Now you have to follow this carefully. I would need a board to explain it for simplicity's sake, but this is quite difficult to explain. Abdul Muttalib, who was the grandfather of the Holy Prophet, had many slaves. When Islam came, slavery already existed. Islam did everything to get rid of slavery through the Sharia, did everything to free slaves. At least in that part of the world, slavery was eventually eliminated because of Islam. Whereas in other parts of the world which didn't have Islam, slavery went away later. He had many slaves, Abdul Muttalib. One of them wasn't very pious and went to pasture the cattle. And another slave passed by. Now, once it was a female slave that Abdul Muttalib had. She wasn't a pious woman. She went to pasture the cattle. And in the valley, another slave passes by, male, who also wasn't practicing, and they become intimate. The woman becomes pregnant. Abdul Muttalib finds out. Now, this was out of wedlock. He's very embarrassed. But since Abdul Muttalib was very kind, very generous, and so on and so forth, gives money to that woman and say, just go away now. Because, you know, you've done something which is totally embarrassing. So now the woman has a male offspring. The offspring of that encounter was male. So the mother and this male child, they go off another place. 15, 16 years on, this male offspring, who now is 15 or 16, becomes intimate with the mother. And they produce a female offspring. Now, being totally embarrassed about this, because this is mother and this is, you know, incest, they send the female offspring to be nurtured by another family, and they just want to forget the whole thing. This female offspring is now being raised in another family. That 15 or 16 year old male offspring who was born out of wedlock, 15 years on, I was 30, passes by a house and sees that female offspring, which is his own daughter, but he doesn't know, and asks for the girl's hand in marriage, and they marry. You see, look at the, it's becoming messy now. The offspring was a male offspring, and that offspring was the one of the people who hit Lady Fatima. He had to go under those kind of things. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, look at the genealogy and you'll get the answer. Wa sallallahu alayhi wa sallam.